Okay, so welcome to, I think this is week 10 of section for CSE 75. I think this is likely to be our last section. We're pretty much wrapping things up. The next couple lectures are going to be about security and scalability, as I recall. So while we're talking about those topics, you'll basically be working on your final projects and submitting the framework and all that fun kind of stuff. So what I want to talk about this week, I think, is first of all, do a bit of an assignment to postmortem, because there were some issues I noticed in a lot of projects that I think I'd like to talk about. And then we're going to go into a little bit of jQuery and just do some kind of interactive code writing. I don't have a whole lot of pre-prepared code this week, because I think it's more fun to kind of dive into jQuery and do it from the start, because it's a little bit, it's different from JavaScript, but I think more intuitive in the end. So, but before we go into the postmortem, I'll start off as usual by asking for questions, just about lecture or anything in general. Okay, looks like we don't have any. So the first major issue I noticed on project 2. I'm sure people were happy to have stopped thinking about project 2 by now, but I'm sorry, I'm going to bring it back up. The major issue was transactions and how to handle synchronization and avoid race conditions. So someone can remind me, what was the major race condition we were trying to avoid in project 2? What was the really big deal? Yeah, so mostly this centered around the user's cash. And I mean, there's also race conditions where you could conceivably sell the same stock twice or something, but a lot of it had to do with updating the cash field, because unlike the cash field isn't represented by a whole row, so it's not inserting and deleting, it's just an update query, which can be a little bit harder to synchronize in some cases. So people generally were pretty good about attempting to use transactions and either that or table locking to solve this problem. But I noticed this happening a lot. So suppose what we want to do is buy a stock. So what are the logical steps you need to take in order to buy a stock? First thing you need to check is what? Yeah, so we need to check the stock's price, multiply it by the number of shares the user wants, and then check that against what from the database? Yeah, the cash. So I want to make sure that price, total price, is less than cash remaining. And then if it is, then we can go ahead and let them buy the stock. And if not, we need to throw an error. Now, of course, you can handle this beforehand by just when the user submits without even trying to insert. What a lot of people did, and this is correct, is they checked the price, and if it was too much, they just said, no, you can't buy this, and stopped immediately, which is fine. But when you check this the first time, so people were doing this. They selected the cash, and then if there was enough of it, then, you know, insert new stock, reduce cash. And this part was the transaction. So is this OK, or can there possibly be a race condition here? Is there any situation in which this code could fail to do what was intended, or fail to pass all the checks that you intended it to pass? Perhaps it would be easier if, so imagine there's two of these. And then you have the same transaction over here. Can you think of an order in which these operations could happen that would result in something bad going on?
Well, if they checked them out at the same time.
Exactly. So the problem is that the only parts that people were synchronizing were the insert and the update. So I mean, in a way, it doesn't make sense to synchronize a select, because you're thinking to yourself, I mean, two selects can happen at the same time, right? There's nothing wrong with that. But the problem is that the select, the checking that there's enough money, needs to be atomic along with the act of actually buying the stock. Because otherwise, you can have a situation where this happens first, this happens second, this happens third, and this happens fourth. Which means that both of the two PHP pages that are executing, think that enough is true. So as a result, they happily go ahead and do this transaction. And the database is perfectly happy to let you, reduce the user's cash twice or even to a negative number. because there's nothing in there that says, you know, don't let a user buy a stock if they don't have enough money for it. That's all being checked in your PHP. So how can we solve this? There's two major approaches, I would say. So what might be the first one? How can we fix this code so that it does what we hope that it would do?
Put it all in one transaction.
Yeah, so the first way we can do this is move this brace, this is our transaction again in the braces, up here. So now the way this works is it depends actually on the database server. So there are settings you can have in a database server that allow what are called, I think, dirty selects or dirty reads, which basically say, you know, allow people to read data that's changed, don't make selects atomic, only things that actually modify the database are atomic. So in order to tell whether that's the case on your database, you probably have to know a little bit more about configuration. But in general, most databases are configured such that this will work. And the way this actually happens is this will be selected, and that'll put kind of a, not so much a lock on the database as it'll say if anything tries to modify this row now that it's been selected here, if anything tries to modify it in any other transaction, then the transactions will fail and get rolled back. So that's perfectly fine. There's another way to do this that actually doesn't necessarily involve putting the select in the transaction. And David actually used it in some lecture code. I don't know if anyone saw that. So, whoops, I wanted to leave that up there. I just want to erase that. Anyone happen to pick up on that? Okay, so I think he only did it on like one page, so it's reasonable if you didn't. Another thing you can do is, at the bottom of this transaction, once you've done this, check the cache once again. And by the time you're down here, you know that your own reduction should have happened, so cache should be somewhat reduced from what it was before, but it better not be negative. So you can check cache again, and if it's negative, so negative, you can roll back the query. And that achieves basically the same effect as doing it the other way. So this is perhaps a little bit better in that you know, it's not so dependent on database configuration, I think. But the configuration issues are a little nebulous. So basically, either one should be fine. But the most important thing is that your read needs to be atomic. Your read that makes sure that this is a valid query you make on the database needs to be atomic, part of the atomic operation, or else you're not actually preventing all the race conditions that could conceivably occur. Any questions on any of this? Okay. And of course, if you're using the lock tables method, it's just the same thing. You need to lock the table before the select so that you know for a fact nothing is changing that table you know, when you're checking whether the user, or after you check that the user has enough cache. So that's good. Next thing I wanted to talk about a bit is error handling on transactions. So I'm going to erase this, I think. So what's the general failure mode for a transaction? What happens when, you know, you check whether one of your commands worked or not, or like, you know, you get an error back from MySQL error after you try and insert? What do you do? Like, what happens with the transaction? What's the entire point of transactions? So you do a rollback, right? It says, okay, all the stuff I just did, forget about it. Put the database back the way it was before into a state that we knew was correct, because everything we did before was also in a transaction. So we can't have an inconsistent state in the database. So you roll back on error. But what does this mean for the user? So what happens when, you know, you get an error like any other error, then you do, you know, MySQL query rollback, and then what? Then what does the user see if you wrote your pages like most people? So they see that it didn't work, right? Like, this means that the user sees a failure. Which is interesting, because in the previous case I was just talking about, both of those transactions, because you had a race condition that caused, you know, the database integrity to no longer be true, in the case where that is, you have transaction, select, and then stuff happens. You know, if both of those selects try to happen, then both transactions will actually fail. This means that you had two perfectly valid operations fail, even though one of them actually could have gone through safely, right? So this is kind of a minor point, and I don't want to make it sound like a huge deal. But in some cases, you can actually fail more gracefully than this. So after you roll back the query, you know, you can conceivably try it again, is the point I'm getting at. Now, you don't want to write like a while loop or anything to try it again forever, because there are situations in which, you know, obviously if two pages are trying this at the same time and both of them proceed to try again forever, then nothing will ever get done because the transaction will repeatedly fail for one of them. Or in fact, you could even write this in different kinds of cases. So if you actually check the value of MySQL error, then perhaps you could have them try again until you get an error that's different from a transactional error. So that is to say, you have that failure mode where both those transactions fail. You go back to the top, try it again. This time, they interleave in such a way that one succeeds. So that one will get out fine. And the other one will fail again, but it won't fail in the transaction. It'll fail on the step where you check for cache, right? So you can discriminate between errors, the result of which will be that basically you're limiting the extent to which the user has to go back and type in something over and over again until it works. So you can have your site handle failures in a graceful manner and, you know, just improve the user experience. This isn't something like anyone would take off points for while grading a project. It's just kind of a neat thing you can do to avoid showing your user kind of unsightly transactional problems. Because, you know, when one user is individually accessing, suppose you have a big company that's trading stocks, and, you know, I'm responsible for this one stock and I try to trade it, and my neighbor in the cubicle across the hall try to trade a different stock, I'm going to be annoyed if my valid trade that should have gone through fails because he tried one at the same time. So ideally, you should limit the extent to which users see those kinds of failures. Any questions about that? Okay. Let's see, what else did I want to do? Oh yeah, there's one other thing. So outside the realm of databases now, just sort of general. So I saw a lot of people who were very assiduously checking errors, and that's good. And it would be stuff like, you know, if, you know, not valid for stock symbol or something, then they would print a message, and then they would, you know, clean up some stuff, and then they would presumably die. Or worse yet, they would set, like, you know, error equals true. So basically, they would do this for, like, a whole bunch of different errors. And then at the end, they would check, like, if this error is true, or this error is true, or this error is true from based on this, or this error is true, then don't print the rest of the page. Else, go ahead and do it. Can we think of a better way to do this? Then, first of all, if we're doing this over and over, what's the immediate problem that jumps out at you? What key combination are you using a lot that preferably you don't use so much when you're programming?
What are we missing?
No, like, what are you doing over and over? What I'm getting at is copy and paste, basically. So there are people who were definitely, for a fact, copying and pasting blocks of code that looked like this. Because, you know, who wants to type this over and over again? But what should you generally do when you have code that you're copying and pasting? What does that tell you about your code?
Make a function.
Yeah, make a function for it. So if you look at David's lecture code, again, I don't know which week, he has a function called apologize, which bundles up the act of printing an error message, and then conceivably you could add cleanup there as well, so you could check if you had an open database connection or something and close it, and then dying, you know, and adding, of course, a link to go back to the beginning or something. So this is really something you want to do because you don't want, first of all, your code clogged up with tons of error messages. And this also means that, you know, if you made a mistake in one of these, like, for example, I don't know, conceivably you could forget to clean up something, or if this changes as you go along, then if the state of your page changes, you could clean up the wrong thing because you were copying and pasting so happily. If you write all of it in one function, then you know that there's one entry point there, and you know that in this function you have to handle all the possible states. So you're more likely to get it right. And then anytime you come up with any kind of new error that might occur, you can just go straight to this function, this apologize function. The other thing I wanted to get at is that, on this note, a lot of people handle errors by doing something akin to let's see, what did they do? It was like they set like a post variable or something, and then they would do a header command to redirect, and then they would just proceed on with the page. This is pretty subtle, but what has to be true for the header command to actually make your pages safe and be a good way of handling errors? There was only like one or two people that did this, but it's worth mentioning. Actually, I'm not even going to ask this one as a question because it's obscure. The header command is just something that tells the browser, would you please go to this page? If I'm a malicious user and I'm connected manually, you know, just entering requests, or I just happen to be using a bad browser, or most interestingly, I'm a web crawler, I won't observe the header command. All it's telling the browser is, you should change the page you're on now to this page. But the browser can say no. And if you continue to execute after this, that is, if you don't always combine header with exit, you have a potential huge bug in your page. And I remember reading a funny story on the internet about how this company with, you know, this code in production that did all this interesting stuff, the way they handled login was like, if you weren't logged in, they would just do header to the login page. And then the page would just proceed as normal. And they had this strange bug that no one could figure out, that like these rows just kept disappearing from the database. And they had logs of all the people who were supposed to be using the website, and they checked the logs for those people, and they weren't touching anything. So finally someone dumped the HTTP logs, and in there was like AlexaBot or something, .alexa.com. And then they realized it was accessing this page, ignoring the header, and then just executing through the page and deleting rows from the database and causing all kinds of havoc, just in its effort to index the page, not even maliciously. So you can imagine how bad it would be if a malicious user got hold of this. But the point of this is that while header is a good way to handle errors in the sense that, you know, you can direct the user away from the page with an error and back to your start page, you always need to combine it with exit, or else it's not actually safe code. Any questions about this? All right, good. So that's all I want to say about assignment two. I felt that was valuable because I bet a lot of you are going to be using databases for your final project, and getting that synchronization right is really key, especially since I've heard some people are planning on writing websites for their business. So the next thing I wanted to talk about today, is that going to work? Okay, great, was jQuery. So, Chris, do you know if it's okay if I use this? So as you've heard by now in lecture, and I think I mentioned it last week as well, jQuery is a library for JavaScript. Take you to the neat splash page they have, right? So as I say, it's a fast and concise JavaScript library that simplifies HTML, document traversing, blah, blah, blah. What does that mean? So the point is that you've noticed by now that doing certain things in JavaScript is kind of a pain. So if I go back to an example from a while ago, it was this, right? Yeah, so it's like index 3. Or better yet. Okay, so, I mean, look at this. We've got document.form, some form elements, name, dot value, just to get one value of one thing in the form. And likewise, if I go to index 4, or maybe it was in week 9, or I can't remember exactly where all the examples went, but okay, yeah, now we want to insert a DOM element. Now it looks like document.body.insert for new element, document.getElements by tag name, form, 0. So what I'm getting at here is that JavaScript is really verbose. For whatever reason, I mean, Java also is pretty verbose, and JavaScript and Java are related, so it makes sense that, you know, they have this very hierarchical structure, and there's good reasons for that, but the problem is when you're writing a website, you don't want to sit there typing the same thing over and over and over again. And it gets even worse when you start doing things that modify the DOM or change styles in CSS, or God forbid, if you want to make an animation on your website, like animating something, opening or closing, forget it. That's going to take 20 lines of code and they're all going to be long. So the idea behind jQuery is that it allows us, it's just a library that allows you to do these things in very short code snippets. So for example, I'll pick a fun one. They have these effects. One of them is this slide down effect. So look at that. All done in including the hide. You know, you don't even have to include the hide. You can conceivably just show. And then you could do that in basically 5 lines of code, including the closing brace. And all sorts of other fun things. So jQuery just allows you to get away from the monotony of writing all these JavaScript functions to do stuff yourself, and gives you a ready-made library to do it with. But the syntax is a little weird, so I thought what we would do today is kind of start from scratch, make a simple page, and then go progressively bigger and see what kind of interesting things we can do with jQuery. And I don't know exactly how long that'll take, but I think we should be able to have some fun with it. So let's start with, what do we agree was a good text error? You know what, I'll just do this. me a moment to get my text editor open here. So I guess I'll just start talking while we wait. The first interesting thing about jQuery is that all of the bit jQuery is based on these things called selectors. So the idea with jQuery is that the selectors allow you to pick something on the page. That can be a group of elements, a single element, elements that have a certain ID, stuff like that, or just the document itself for other things, like adding, for example, handlers for events that apply to the entire page, and do stuff with them. So the power of selectors is that you can select based on pretty much anything you've learned so far. So you can select using CSS selectors, which you're probably familiar with. That is, you know, if you have class, you can type .class, or if you have, no, don't do that. If you want, for example, li elements that are children of a specific ul element, you can do that. And you can also select using xpath, which gives you the power to do some cool things with, say, attributes, which are a little bit harder. Oh, it's going to make me put the right password here. No. Okay, cool. So as I was saying, and you can also select based on XPath. So yeah, you can use attributes, you can do all kinds of complicated queries, and of course, you know, you can't really do it on XML that you create. It's still based on the HTML DOM, but that's still a nifty feature, I think. So well, I guess we'll start pretty simple and just demonstrate a few of the easier things you can do with selectors, like adding event handlers, say, or just changing the color of something, and then we'll maybe get into some of the animations. And finally, if I have a moment and I can find some good Google Maps code to base it on, we can try to combine the two. All right. So the first thing you want to do is include...
Make that a little bigger.
Oh, right. Sorry. Is include this the same way you include the Google Maps API. But there's kind of a nifty thing here in that you can just download jQuery and store it on your own server. So the good thing about that is that, first of all, you're not limited by your internet connectivity if you want to develop, for example, you know, on a plane or something. Yeah, that's fine. That's way too big. Does that look okay? Yeah. All right. And the other good thing about it is that you can actually read the code yourself. It's not obfuscated. So if we take a look at what jQuery looks like, it's actually kind of interesting for educating yourself. Here it is. This is the verbose version, or whatever they call it. So I'm not going to go through this entire thing, obviously, but this is just the jQuery source code, and you can read through it if you like. It's quite long. So long, in fact, that it appears to be freezing the text editor. Oh, okay. And see how they do things. So this is very advanced, obviously, and you wouldn't be expected to understand it if you looked at it now. But this can be an interesting way if you are curious how they do a certain thing with jQuery to go under the hood and take a look. So anyway. And then we'll add a space for our own JavaScript under there. Okay, so now we have a page which presumably will load up with jQuery without an error. The other good thing about the way jQuery works is, I forgot to chmod, you can actually debug it with Firebug, unlike Google's code. So you've probably noticed if you make a mistake with, that looks good, if you make a mistake when you're doing a Google Maps thing, it just pops up like, you know, there'd be an error down at the bottom of Firebug. Then you go to console to look at what it is, and it'll tell you something like a.a is undefined at line 3 of, you know, 7.js, which tells you absolutely nothing, and you don't even know where the error occurred. So you can step through all this obfuscated code, and you'll never know what check is failing. Whereas if you make a mistake in jQuery, you can actually step into jQuery.js and figure out what's going wrong and figure out what it's looking for that you don't have. So anyway, let's start with something pretty simple. So we'll make a link. Link goes to nothing. We'll say, click me. So as I was saying, jQuery allows you to do things with selectors. I'm trying to remember how you begin. I think it's document. So this selector means select, sorry, needs quotation marks, means select the document. So this is like the same thing when you do document.forms and so on. And then you can set up a handler like so. And now you have basically something that'll just happen on document load. So you've probably seen this on, it's like the Google Maps initialize function. And why is there a breakpoint there? That was weird.
Why did it do that?
Why did it do what?
Firebug.
Junctify. I don't know. I think maybe there was an error. I might have made a typo on the.
Is there a way to make it step through like that?
On its own?
Yeah.
Let me check. I don't know if I did something to do that. Oh, here it is, I think. Yeah, okay. So this is actually kind of useful. There's this option down here, break on all errors. So if you select the break on all errors right under options when you have the script tag selected, then every time an error happens, it'll automatically jump to it instead of just doing whatever it does normally, which I think is JavaScript just dies when it hits an error. So that actually is kind of neat. Something to take away. Where was I? So what mistake did I make? I'm vaguely out of practice with jQuery. Oh, document.ready, not document.load, my mistake. All right. Still? OK, I was right the first time. There are no quotes. All right, because document's just a DOM object. That makes sense. This is strange.
The so, end of.
Oh, I forgot my semicolon. Good catch. Now I won't reload the page. Still no? Was that what you were going to say? I might have done maybe I didn't chmod the file that I did beforehand. No, that's fine. This is puzzling.
The function. No, that's.
Well, I guess I'll just copy this and see if that works. And if not, then maybe my version of Firefox is wrong or something. Doesn't seem to. That's really weird.
The jQuery script is in that place, in the same folder?
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. Huh. Is that supposed to be link there? I'm going to be annoyed if that's all it was all along.
What's source?
I don't think it's source. Hang on. Oops. Ah, it is source. You're right. My mistake. So that was probably right before. I went to all that trouble. Okay. So the moral of the story is copy and paste that stuff from a tutorial, or from a template rather, so you don't have to make that mistake every time. Now it's going to work, right? Well, there's no error anymore. Oh, right, because I changed what it does. Okay. So anyway, now that we're finally through that, so what is the source actually doing? You probably learned more about it than I did while I was debugging it. Probably memorized it by now, but anyway. Okay, so what we're doing, first of all, anytime you see a dollar sign, it means you're going to do something with jQuery. So in a way, it's like you know, a language like C or C++, you've got, say, you know, classes. And whenever you're going to do something with a specific class, you preface it with like object dot, or in PHP, object arrow. So the dollar sign in jQuery is the same thing here. Anytime you see a dollar sign, it means this is going to go to jQuery. So I guess the value in that is that it's easy to separate your jQuery from your regular JavaScript, because, for example, alert, you know that's going to be a regular JavaScript function because there's no dollar sign. Whereas, you know, these things are both based on jQuery. The next thing of interest is the selector. So after you see the dollar sign, there's always a pair of parentheses. Or no, almost always. You can do actually dollar sign just dot, and that'll do things as well. But ordinarily, you see the pair of parentheses. And whatever is in the parentheses is known as your selector, which means what is the function I'm going to call past the dot going to operate on? In this case, it's going to be document. Down here, it's going to be this A thing, which I haven't explained yet. And like I said, we'll look at the different formats that can be in a moment. So quotes A, this is the same as a CSS selector. So if you were to write a CSS that said, you know, what this does is makes all the links on your page red, right? It selects all A elements, all anchor elements, and changes color to red. Likewise, when you select just quotes A in jQuery, it says select all A elements on the page and do the next thing to them. So that's easily demonstrable that it applies to everything. If we were to, say, do this twice, and it still does the alert for us. So what are these functions? Document.ready, which I originally thought was called document.load, but it's not, is basically a function that's called when the document loads for the first time. So it's the same thing as doing body on load, which, by the way, I noticed some people in Project 2 who tried to do like div on load and form on load. Only body actually supports on load. So well, you might have browsers that'll do that for you. It's not compliant. So as I was saying, document.ready is equivalent to body on load in that when your page is done loading, meaning the DOM is fully set up, which is important because the fact that this is going to work is dependent on the DOM objects all existing already. We'll call whatever this anonymous function is. And of course, conceivably, this could be a named function as well. But in this case, we made it anonymous. But you could define a function up here that does the same thing and then have document.ready just pass in a reference to that. And finally, this a.click. Well, I mean, now that I've demonstrated it, what do you think it is?
It's an onclick function.
Yeah, it's an onclick event handler. And you can do other things here as well. So I don't know if it's case sensitive or not, but rather than click, you could conceivably have mouse over. Hope that's right. Might be all lowercase. Yeah. Or no, it's hover. Which will give you that effect. So jQuery basically renamed all of the events to their own names for some reason. But if you go to the event reference, which is here, you can go to events, and here they all are. So it's all the same stuff. Blur, focus is down here, I'm sure. Yeah, there's focus, key down, key up, and so on.
Do these event handlers work? Like, some events normally only trigger for certain elements. Do these work for all events, like the click? Like,
can you give any example of like a event that doesn't work for some elements?
I think in Project 1, I was trying to like make sort of like turn divs into pseudo links, like that would have change on hover and change on click and select.
So you should be able to do that. I know for a fact you can do it in jQuery because it's something I'm planning on doing a little bit later. But I think you can do it in regular JavaScript as well. Divs ordinarily support on click, as well as most other stuff, I think. The only event that I know for a fact isn't supported by, like focus isn't supported by things that you can't type in. Were you trying focus?
Yes.
Oh, okay. That'll do it. Yeah, so if the event is defined such that it can't occur on objects of certain types, then it'll fail in jQuery as well because it hooks into the DOM. That's a good question. And so, yeah, in this case, all it does is this alert, which we'll make more interesting in a moment. So any other questions on how this works so far? I think that's pretty straightforward, right? So what interesting things can we do in here? Well, first of all, let's play with the selector a little bit. So we can conceivably have different classes of links on our website. So for example, you might have sidebar links and then links that are, you know, just in your page normally. We can represent this by making these of A class equals This one will be body. And then this one could be, let's say, sidebar. Even though in reality it isn't, but let's pretend. So how would you select those in CSS? Do you remember?
Dot.
Yeah, dot, exactly. So this does exactly what it does in CSS, in that now only A of class body link will be selected. Whoops. Which means that I think this one's the sidebar, right? Nothing. And there we get our alert. By the way, if you remember when I talked about events, I think most of the same people were here. We could put this mysterious E in here, right? And had to be called E. As it turns out, E is also supported by jQuery. So you can include E, which again, if you weren't watching, means data for that actual event that occurred. And then E has various properties like target, for example, which means what received the event, what object triggered the event. And as you can see, it puts in that link for you. So this is interesting because we could conceivably select everything on the page. And then we wouldn't know what had triggered our event. Oh, what triggered that? That's kind of interesting. Yeah, the body. So we selected absolutely everything, so I moused over the body and that triggered it. Unfortunately, Firefox is smart and didn't do it multiple times, but there I get my other link. I got it twice there.
Mouse over, mouse out.
Hover should only fire once, I think, so that must be something subtler than that. I wonder if, I don't know. That's interesting, though. We'll have to look into that more later. But anyway, so the point is that this E thing can tell you data about your event in jQuery just the same as it did in JavaScript. So okay, so we've demonstrated that you can select by class. You can also select using XPath. So let's say, for example, that we want to do. Who can tell me the XPath for things, A tags that have an attribute href equal to that? Or in fact, just A tags that have an attribute href at all. How about? Yeah, so it's obscure, right? I'm pretty sure it's this. Which hopefully means that if I get rid of this here, which is completely invalid, by the way, I assume. I'm doing that again. That shouldn't work anymore. And that still does. So I hope that wasn't just Firefox deceiving us. Let me try that. Yeah, okay. So what we've done there is used XPath instead and said, give me only A's that have a class attribute. And you can go further with this and give me A's, whoops. Give me A's only with a class attribute equal to sidebar link. So we could give this one back its class. And then it'll still only select this one on the right. So any questions about that? I mean, now there's obviously no benefit whatsoever to using class here or class equals here instead of just doing a dot. But the beauty of this is that not everything in CSS can be selected. So CSS isn't really designed to, CSS selectors aren't designed to tell you absolutely everything that you might want to know about an element. But XPath can really, since it's just a way of traversing the DOM, really can tell you absolutely everything. So the fact that you can use XPath syntax here is rather powerful. So what else is interesting that we can do with selectors? So I don't know if you've seen this one before, but it is pretty good. So let's say we make this a child of a paragraph tag. We'll say this paragraph is of class green or something, even though it isn't. This is a CSS selector that says, give me all A's that are children of paragraphs of class green. And now, that one will work, and that one won't. So you can do all kinds of interesting things with this. The idea being that the selector in jQuery is really one of the most powerful things about it, because most of what you do that's obnoxious in JavaScript when you're working with the DOM is typing out that whole, you know, document. Imagine how long it would go. Probably like document dot, you might even have to use a loop for this. It's like document dot body dot so on and so on and so on all the way over here. Whereas here, you just have a very simple CSS selector, or if you prefer XPath selector, if you use that syntax, which will give you precisely the element you want in the most brief way it can be represented, essentially. So that's a good one. All right, so, and is anyone else sick of alert at this point? Yeah. So let's get rid of the alert and do some more interesting things. So one of the cool things, other than I've already hinted at the fact you can modify the DOM, but you can go even further than that. So you can modify attributes as well. And one attribute that we would probably like to modify frequently is the class. I think it's set class, right? So I've introduced something new here. What do you suppose that this means?
Current.
In the context.
Current element?
Yeah, so this is actually like the way this works, I think, at least, I haven't actually checked, is whenever you do a selector like pgreen A, it just sets a variable called this, like inside jQuery, to a reference to whatever element was just selected. So from then on, whenever you refer to this, it just means whatever the thing is that I'm working on right now. So if we were to do another selector in here, then this would refer to whatever was nested most deeply there. So this is just shorthand for not having to select the same thing over and over again, which is pretty convenient. So anyway, let's write some CSS as well, so that'll work. So style type text CSS, and we'll do blue equals color cyan, and with any luck, it'll work. Okay. So what do you suppose is supposed to happen when we do this?
Link changes color.
Right. So, oh, since it's a, oh, that one's not going to work because it's a link. Hang on. Change this to, maybe if I take out the href. Oh, I guess set class out. What is it called? All right, I'll have recourse once more to the documentation then. CSS. That's strange. Oh, add class, okay. That makes more sense anyway, because you might want to do it twice. So we'll add class. This time it'll work. Okay, so it turns cyan for us. The point being that since, of course, you can have multiple classes on one thing, you can, remember, specify as many classes as you want. We can use this to, for example, when a user, you know, obviously you can turn something blue when a user clicks on it. Or more interestingly, let's say a user checks a box, then you could select the corresponding option for that box and, you know, make it bold or something to represent the fact it's been selected. You could do all kinds of neat stuff with add class. And likewise, you can also use some conditionals here. So for example, let's say we want to toggle it back and forth. Then we can do if this dot has class blue, then set it to blue. Else, this dot remove class. And now we can toggle it back and forth. Did I miss a parenthesis? Yes. And back and forth. So, kind of a lame example, but demonstrates. Any questions so far, or any perhaps more interesting to ask would be, is there anything that, now that you've seen this, you think might be interesting to do with it, that you'd like to know how to do with it?
I don't know, but if you could give us a walkthrough of the sort of the API documentation set. I'm not sure I recognize all the various titles of the sections of the API set.
Oh, okay, yeah, sure. Just demonstrate what everything is. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
I know when I look at it, I often have to like check twice before I find what's what. So, sure, we can go through this. Zoom in a bit. Okay, so the left side, obviously, is just kind of support stuff. So jQuery core is, I don't think there's anything in there you'll need. It just basically defines like the dollar sign symbol itself. And is there anything of use in there? I don't think so. We can click on each of them individually and see if there's anything good. As I recall. Yeah, so most of this stuff is just internal. I think this is all mostly internal stuff that it just uses to do whatever it does. I guess size might be interesting. If you could, for example, select a div that has like eight children, it might tell you the number of elements is 8, but I don't know if that would be terribly useful to you. Yeah, so nothing really that good on this page. Selectors is good. Selectors basically defines all the different ways in which you can select stuff, which is what I've been doing mostly so far. So just as we did class with the dot, you can do ID with hash. So you can do things like, for anything with ID, hello, that. Or specifically for the link with ID, hello, you can do that. Same as in CSS. Element, we saw, class we saw, star we saw. And then as in CSS, you can use commas to separate and select multiple things at once. If you can't come up with one single expression that gets everything. And then, yeah, this is just all. Oh, these are good too. These are called CSS. What is it? There's a special name for them. It's not going to come to me. But anyway, if you look at the W3C spec for CSS, you can do, some of these aren't supported by every browser. But you can select, say, for example, the first paragraph that's a child of this div. The last one, whoops, didn't mean to click on that. Even and odd, so if you wanted to make like a table with alternating like gray and white background to make it easier to read across, you can do that. What else do we have? Single element by its index.
So that's index looking context to what you already had. So you have like a
right, so
hash.
Where we put something like this is, for example, let's go with, I'll create a div in a moment. And then we'll say div a first.
Yes.
So let's put these in a div then. Get rid of the P. And if that's done right, then what we should see is that that one does this, and well, that's still a link, so you wouldn't be able to see it anyway, but I take my word for it that it shouldn't work. Yeah, so nothing happens here. This one still works. So you use them exactly as you would in CSS, or basically they go inside the parentheses as part of the selector. That's all you really need to know. But yeah, some of those are pretty fun to use. Another good example they have of first, CSS-wise, is like those books where the first letter of the chapter is big and fancy and then the rest are normal size. So you can do that with first if you feel like it. Yeah. So any questions on selectors?
So if you go one up, like one, yeah, not selector.
Sorry, up.
Down.
Sorry. this, okay.
Yeah,
so
is it the same type of selector as you used in the rest of the, like, is that nested?
So what this would be was like, for example, we want children of div that are not of class blue. And that would mean that if we were to change this to class blue, then it would no longer match. So it's a way of saying, I want this many objects, but okay, take some of them away again. So this one won't work anymore. Or I guess
it
did.
The first one is not the first anymore.
Oh, did I change the first one? No, it's not working at all, in fact, which is weird because it should show up as cyan. That's
two classes.
Unusual. Oh. Thank you. Okay. So this one no longer works. It's no longer deselecting because our selector filtered it out. So yeah, that's all that one does.
So you can use this with that?
Can you use this with that? No, because this is a special object. So this isn't, notice that this is in quotation marks because it's like it's a string selector, so it means it's going to be CSX or XPath, whereas document is an object, a DOM object, and this is a special jQuery object.
So it has to be one type of select.
Yeah, specifically it has to be, I mean, I don't know if you can mix and match XPath and Maybe you can. That's an interesting question. But in any case, you can't use this together with an object.
Okay.
That's a good question, though. So anyway, those are the selectors. Anything else on this? All right. Attributes. Attributes is all about just attributes of DOM elements, basically. Most of it is kind of boring. So you can set attributes. Like, for example, what might you want to do? You could do something like, this is a lame way to do it, but instead of adding class like this, you could say this.attr class blue should do the same thing. Yeah, so that does the same thing. So that might be useful if you wanted to, say, redirect a link to point to somewhere different from where it pointed to begin with. And you can also remove attributes in that way. I already showed you the different class things you can do. Oh, toggle class, so I probably should have used that one. I didn't know that existed. But so rather than what I had here with the if statement, you could just use toggle class. Pretty interesting. And then, yeah, this is just all about interacting with the DOM, essentially. HTML, text, val. Any questions about this stuff? Okay.
I saw one that said it was index, EQ index.
Index, that was back on selectors. So what index is remember when you get the children of a node from the DOM, and then like you refer to them with array syntax 0, 1, 2. So if you were to get, how'd I say this? Maybe an example.
My question is that if you have different elements, say like div has a couple of A's and a couple of P's or something.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so index will select them in order from the first one.
Okay.
So EQ0 is the first one that matches, the EQ2-1 is the second one that matches, and so on.
Okay.
And that's not necessarily, they don't have to be in the same place in the DOM, so you could have... It'll still work, but I can't guarantee what order to select in. So you could have something like, you know, P, and then you have an A over here, then close P, and you have another A down here. I think it probably goes in order. So if you were just to select A, then this would be A0, this would be A1. Even though they're in different parts of the DOM hierarchically, I think that would work.
But what about this .eq? That's what I'm talking about.
Right, that's what I'm saying. So you could do a selector that looks like...
So it would be A.eq, not it would be or P.eq. It wouldn't just be like .eq by itself, right?
Oh, no, not just by... I mean, I think you actually could do that. And then it would just get all elements. You could do... Could you do star? Yeah, you could probably do star.eq. And then that's lame, obviously, because you're just counting from the top and there's all kinds of elements in your document, but...
Okay. Makes sense.
All right. The more fun ones are after this. So traversing. Traversing is pretty cool because it allows you to, how to put this, it's kind of like not, but even better. So you can do a selector and then narrow it down further and further using stuff like filter, which most interesting takes a function. So let's perhaps write an example of that. So simplify all this. Just select all A's. Then you could do this dot filter function to, and what might we want to filter on? Perhaps this dot ML. No, that's boring. Who can think of a good thing to filter on that would be simple? Oh, we can do has class, maybe. So what is this a very verbose way of doing? Or hang on. So this is not the right way to do it. What will this very verbose string, assuming that JavaScript doesn't mind the line breaks, actually do? Note that this is all one expression here from the beginning. So first of all, we're selecting all A elements. Then we're filtering based on the result of this function, which will return whether this has class blue. And then on everything we've gotten from here, we set a click handler, the result of which is that it should only happen for things that have class blue. Now, we already demonstrated a way to do that much more simply, but that worked, and that didn't, right? So we already demonstrated a way to do this much more simply, but you can conceive of a filter that would perhaps make use of other variables in your JavaScript that you already defined. I mean, this page doesn't have any, but Google Maps.
Filter only takes a Boolean function?
Filter returns a Boolean value, true or false. So the way this works is, if you've ever seen Scheme, for example, suppose we select all A's. What filter does is calls the function, that you the anonymous function there, or you can name the function, put it elsewhere, and it'll call it on and call it on this. And if it returns true, it stays in the selection. And if it returns false, it's taken away from the selection.
Whatever function you give to it has to return Boolean.
Yes, okay. That's right. In this case, because has class returns true or false, this works.
Okay.
So filter's a way of basically narrowing down a selection that we had. What else is on that page? So map is another interesting one. This is another Scheme takeaway. So let's do this. Let's not do that. It's a good example. This is tough. So we could perhaps alert this natter class. Okay, so what should happen here is that we go over everything in the selection calling this function on it. So in this case, it's going to alert whatever is in the class of each thing as soon as the page loads. So that one says body link, that one says sidebar link blue. See that? So again, you can. This is obviously much more powerful in a context where you can think of something interesting to do with it. But okay, and I think we're kind of running short on time, so I'm going to limit the rest to stuff that's really cool. So let's say these are all pretty good, but I want to mainly talk about, first of all, manipulation, which is changing the DOM. So two things to take away from here. I don't think I can do demos because we got bogged down a little bit in having fun with the selectors. But so first of all, append. What append will do is take whatever you have selected currently and add stuff to it within the HTML. So if you have append and call it on this p tag, stuff will get entered in right down here before the close p tag. The other thing is inserting outside. So if you call p and then do something with after, it'll be inserted down here. So you can actually call dot after and then insert a whole new p tag with stuff in it like that. And you can add a DOM element just like that by specifying the actual HTML for the DOM element. So you don't need to create the element as you would in JavaScript and then manually insert it. You can actually kind of interact with the text of your web page like this almost. The other thing I want to talk about, we've already gone over CSS quite a bit and events, is effects. And the big ones here are show and hide. So the beauty of show and hide and also toggle are that you can have links, for example, that say, I have an example of this one, or do I? No, I don't, unfortunately. You can have links that say, for example, suppose you have a bar, and then 1, 2, 3 on the bar, and for each one of those, you show a different thing. So let's say you have a picture page, and you want a user to be able to click a link to select a picture and display text about it. You can do that without even needing Ajax by setting them all to, for example, I think I'm saying we're not on tape anymore. Is that right? Okay. Yeah. So unfortunately, I didn't get through everything I wanted to today because, I don't know, jQuery is kind of tough. But that's all the time we have, unfortunately. And I encourage you to come to the jQuery website and explore all of it yourself because it's really cool and you can do a lot of interesting things with it. And definitely post on the bulletin board and, the final project forum or something if you're interested in using this and you want to know an interesting thing to do. There's a few things I didn't cover, including Ajax. But so definitely please take a look at this and let us know if you have any questions. So thanks for tuning in once again, or coming for those who are here physically. And yeah, that's it.